Call the House Healthcare Committee to order for February 17th. It's my intention to quickly work the bills we have to work, get those out of the way so some of our members would need to leave, and then move very quickly to the hearings. Also, wouldn't hurt if we were out of here by 2 o'clock because there's a floor session, but we can hang out. First, an announcement. We're going to carry over Senate Bill 1503 until Monday. Carry it over. Open a work session on Senate Bill 1504A. Madam Administrator, will you tell us about 1504A, please?
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1504A, we received the public hearing on it on the 15th of February from John Powell, who outlined the provisions of the bill. This exempts the insurers from any second requirement to send a notice of cancellation of the health insurance benefit if the cancellation is due to non-payment of premium. That is currently outlined in ORS 743565, and it does some other technical fixes that were unintended consequences of Senate Bill 89 from 2011. This left the Senate floor with 30 ayes. It has a no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
Do I have a motion, Mr. Co-Chair?
Yes. Chair Grinlick, I move Senate Bill 1504 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, 1504A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Thompson moves Senate Bill 1504A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Dorby?
Aye.
Representative Penny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Parrish?
Excused.
Vice Chair Hoyle?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kinnamer?
Excused.
Co-Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Motion passes, and yes. Senate Bill 1504 is on the way to the floor. Somebody like to carry this? Anybody? Conger? Representative Hoyle will carry 1504. Close the work session on Senate Bill 1504. Open a work session on Senate Bill 1507A. Will you please tell us about that bill?
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, again, 1507A engrossed. We had the public hearing on February 15th. This removes the specific requirement that a person getting an HIV test give separate informed consent, and it also replaces a person with a health care provider, which was amended on the Senate floor, or in the Senate Health Care Committee. This left the Senate floor with 30 ayes. There's no revenue impact, and there's a no fiscal impact, Mr. Co-Chair.
And there was no opposition to it that we heard?
Well, there was. The ACLU came to the table and had...
Oh, that's right. Modest opposition.
Yeah. Modest opposition.
Is there any... a motion?
Chair Grinlick, I move Senate Bill 1507A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Thompson moves Senate Bill 1507A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? No. Okay. Would you call the roll, please?
It's Friday.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Parrish?
Excuse.
Vice Chair Hoyle?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kinnamer?
Excuse.
Co-Chair Thompson?
Aye.
And Co-Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Motion carries. This is such an important bill. We're going to have co-carriers on it. We're going to have Representative Kenny Geyer and Representative Doherty co-carrying the bill.
Thank you.
That works for you guys. You can divide up how you want to do it. Motion passes. It's on its way. Close the work session on Senate Bill 1507. Open a work session on Senate Bill 1565. We have a motion. Tell us about this bill, please?
Just to refresh your memory, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1565A. It permits supervising physicians or the supervising physician organization to apply to the Oregon Medical Board for dispensing authority for physician assistance. You'll remember Led Bergstein gave us public testimony on the 15th of February on behalf of Zoom Care. There's no revenue impact on the bill, and there is a fiscal statement that just outlines some expenditures to the Board of Pharmacy and the Medical Board.
And no subsequent.
Sir. No subsequent referral. This left the Senate floor with 27 ayes, 1 no, and 2 excused, Mr. Co-Chair.
Okay. Can I have a motion, Mr. Co-Chair?
Chair Greenlee, I move Senate Bill 1565A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Thompson moves Senate Bill 1565A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Can you please call the roll?
Representative Conger.
Aye.
Representative Doherty.
Aye.
Representative Kenny Guyer.
Aye.
Representative Parrish.
Excuse.
Vice Chair Hoyle.
Aye.
Vice Chair Kinnamer.
Excuse.
Co-Chair Thompson.
Aye.
Co-Chair Greenlee.
Aye. Motion passes. Senate Bill 1565 is on its way to the floor. You want it or me, Jim?
I can take it.
Representative Thompson will carry 1565. Close the work session on Senate Bill 1565. I think that's it, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. When Representative Parrish comes, we'll suspend rules to give her a chance to vote on the three of them as well. You might leave her a message. That way that we voted on three bills, and we'll suspend the rules for when she comes to allow her to vote on it. Close the work session on Senate Bill 1565. And open an informational hearing on the health engagement model. Call Diane Lovell and Sean Coleman. Yes. Oh. Okay. You okay?
Who wants to wait?
Jim? They'd rather not be long. You're here for the next one?
Interesting.
Why don't you join us? We'll open both of them. Maybe you can make an opening statement, and then we'll get back into that, too. All right? So hang in, Rick.
What's that?
Okay. I'll also open a work session on newborn screening for... an informational hearing on newborn screening for Krebs disease. And invite Representative Widener to make an opening statement. Then we'll come back to the other one.
Thank you, Co-Chair Greenlee, Co-Chair Thompson. And for the record, I am State Representative Jim Widener, who reside in Yamhill County and cover most of Yamhill County, a little bit of Polk County, and hopefully at some point some of Washington County to get closer to my dear Co-Chair Greenlee here. So,
I'm going the other way as fast as I can. I'm going east, unfortunately.
Yes. So soon they'll catch on to our nepotism. But for the record, I am glad that this is not a work session because I did not have any legislation prepared for today. So, and it would have come to a surprise. But one of the things I have had a chance to do is meet with some constituents in my district, and I want to thank you for allowing time to meet some very good-hearted constituents who want to share with you some information about a very serious disease, Krabbe's disease. Most often shows signs in newborn infants, to which, when included in universal newborn screening, an active response to this medical condition can dramatically affect longevity and outcome of the diagnosed child. Tammy and David Wilson will offer some testimony here and some insight to this disease in a short time, and they have been involved with this. It's been something that's consumed their lives with their children and everything, and they shared with me in my office here last session. We put together some time. I thought it was important for the health care committee to hear this bill. At that time, I was still part of this committee, but I think it's something that will be very informative for you and something for us to look at addressing possibly in the upcoming session. So, but we need to get the information and see what we need to do to attack this disease. It was brought to the forefront probably with quarterback Jim Kelly, because his child had Krabbe's disease and passed away with it and has a book out on it. So they will share with you some of the stories that they've had with that and everything and what's happened with the screening that has taken place with their children. With that, we can move into the other informational hearing, and they will do a very good job. They are very competent people on sharing and bringing attention to the disease. They'll do a much better job than I ever could, because I couldn't even pronounce Krabbe's when they first came in. So.
Representative Widener, thank you for bringing this matter to us. Well, I'm looking forward to the hearing. Okay, you're on.
Co-chairs Greenlich and Thompson, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Colmer, chair of the Public Employees Benefit Board. And with me is our vice chair, Diane Lovell. We'll sort of split some duties today. We have a paper PowerPoint coming your way that we'll sort of walk through. And at the request of co-chair Thompson, we wanted to give you a little insight on an overview of the health engagement model that the PEB board had adopted in this sort of new round of benefits, give you some history and context of where PEB has been, where we're trying to go, and then Diane will walk through the decision-making process of PEB and sort of where we are currently as of, you know, middle of February in sort of implementing this. So just as a reminder for everybody, PEB covers 50,000 employees and 76,000 covered dependents, so we do have a large stake in the healthcare system, and we purchase healthcare for a lot of individuals. On the second slide, it shouldn't be news to anybody on this committee. Obviously, in the governor's work around transformation, the current cost trends are completely unsustainable, and PEB is not immune to that. You can see the trends here, and PEB, like nationally in other commercial markets, our population's getting older, has a lot of chronic disease that's driving costs higher and higher. So PEB is not unique in these cost trends and these drivers of healthcare costs. On the third slide, just gives you a little bit of an overview of what PEB has tried to do to mitigate those issues. Things like being a tough negotiator. PEB goes out for contract and tries to get the best deal it can for the money that we have. So that's sort of one thing that they do. The second thing has been moving to self-insurance. So being more of a manager of our money than just sort of contracting with somebody to do the work for us. And then the last two there are really around the first, delivery system design. So what are our expectations around medical home, primary care, where our members should be seen for preventative and primary care medicine to avoid those high-cost things that are driving healthcare costs. And then lastly there, benefit changes. How do we create an evidence-based benefit design that promotes prevention and primary care, that removes the barriers to prevention and primary care, more importantly, so people are incented to go get the right care at the right place at the right time. With that said, other benefit changes are also about cost shifting, about shifting the cost to members instead of having the state pick up the cost. So as you start talking about benefit design and trying to control quote-unquote costs, we're really sort of moving the dollars around and figuring out who's paying the difference. As you all know, and as many of your constituents have told you, there's new cost shifting that's happening right now within the Public Employees Benefit Board around premium contribution, co-pays, deductibles. So those are sort of the old tricks to try to figure out how to contain costs. On the next slide, with all of those things, and these are all things that the commercial population does, other large purchasers do, so this isn't, again, unique to what PEB has been trying to do, but I think everybody's acknowledging that even with those efforts, we're not mitigating trend. We're not changing the cost curve from a purchasing perspective. So what do we have to move to next? Well, this fourth slide really is what we need to start moving towards. So how do we engage members in their health, and how do we actually improve health so we keep the healthy healthy, for the folks who are less healthy, improve their health, or at least maintain where they are, and then those folks with chronic disease, how to help them better manage their disease and navigate the system. And that's more than just changing benefits or changing how things are paid for. It's really how we get engagement from not only the purchasing side, the provider side, and also the patient side. So as, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on your perspective, I wasn't on the PEB board until November. And so as PEB started looking at, well, what else can we do? if these traditional methods aren't getting us the kind of health and cost decreases or cost mitigations we would like, what's out there? What are other things that are possible? So staff and consultants and others, the governor's office, some of the union representatives sort of started bringing models to the table saying, what else can we do? And taking from other states, most directly connected with us, King County, Washington, is doing some pretty exciting things. And then others like SAFE, OHSU, Intel, are engaging in more of how do they engage employees directly around their health that complements the benefit design work that they're doing. For the current health engagement model, I think it's fair to say that the two models that PEB looked at most intensely and have showed, quite frankly, the best promise have been King County, Washington, and AFSCME Council 31 in Illinois. So a lot of the work that Diane will show you around how the model was put together sort of leans on not only those two models, but also sort of that last citation for those of you who need some light reading at night, can read about some of the evidence around some of these programs to sort of give you a sense of, you know, the PEB board didn't make these choices lightly. They made them based on science and based on what we know to date and the best science to date. So the next slide really sort of lays out some of the keys in that evidence and that research around wellness programs. You know, the first thing is getting employees to understand what are their health risks. Really doing an assessment. Who's what? You know, the conversation's always, you know, 20% of our population are driving 80% of our costs. Well, how do we identify those 20%? And also, how does the employer, purchaser, provider identify that 20% and all work together to improve the health and eventually lower costs? So there's other there's all kinds of pathways after you get past that assessment, and I think we're still learning what are the best ways to do that. But right out of the gate, you have to get a real assessment. Who's healthy, who's not healthy, who has chronic disease, and then figure out how to push resources in the appropriate place. So lastly, for me anyway, is one of the keys to this, and Diane will talk a little bit about this later, is how do you get employees to engage? And I think the real point that we have to make first is the incentive has to be big enough to get engagement. You'll probably hear from some of the plans about this. Health risk assessments are not new. They're not novel. There's a lot of evidence to show how you can use them. The trick is, how do you get people engaged? How do you get people to actually take them? How do you get people to actually do that first step and then figure out how to put the resources in the right places? So that's really the first step. So you identify, then track those risk factors. So, for example, if Sean is eating too many potato chips, how do I help him learn that he should only eat one bag of potato chips instead of three? Those are the kinds of things we have to start getting towards. And that's going to depend on the person and their resources and what their provider is telling them and what their family dynamic is. A big piece, obviously, for our population is worksite. So we spend a lot of hours, especially during short February sessions, in our workplaces. So how do we support worksite wellness? How do we support an environment where it actually allows employees to make the right choices? How do we create that kind of environment? And then lastly, sort of consistency. So how are we all, as employers, purchasers, providers, family members, have the same message about how we're doing this all together? So with that, I'll let Diane sort of talk about PEB's decision-making process around the health engagement model, but I hope that gives you good context for where PEB was and is and will be going. Okay.
Thank you, Sean. So you see from slide 9. Oh, yes.
Do I need to open a work session for it? I don't know. We can just suspend the rules right now.
No, that one. No, we don't have to do that in the middle of our testimony.
Well, that's okay, dude. You want to move to suspend the rules so you can go to the 3?
Mr. Chair, I move we suspend the rules and allow Representative Parrish to vote on Senate Bill 1504A, 1507A, and 1565A.
Is there any objection to suspending the rules?
How do you vote?
I will vote yes, yes, and yes, and I apologize for my lateness. Our co-speakers showed up at Our Ladies at the Legislature, and we ran a little over, so I always wanted to honor their time. So thank you.
Thanks, people. You have recorded? Okay. I'm sorry. Diane, go ahead.
No problem at all. Thank you. So you'll see on slide 9 the hemp chronology that we have worked through over the winter and summer. So as was mentioned, we learned about the model from Chicago, from AFSCME Illinois 31, through a couple of different venues, and we began to investigate that. We invited representatives out here to provide some presentations. We did some research, and that all began to happen in February. We formed then a PEB subcommittee, a labor management subcommittee, to look further into what other models might look like, what might our goals be, what might a plan for Oregon look like. And we had several meetings over the spring. You will see that in May of 2011, the board formally agreed to form a HEM, a Health Engagement Model Program. We then asked staff to do some additional work in developing a program, looking at what the criteria might be, what the different elements would be, how it would be implemented. And I just do want to emphasize that the board and the goal of the board was to get something implemented by the January 2012 plan year. And so we were under a very short time constraint, as you can see from this chronology. In July, we formally agreed with the staff recommendations, and you'll see there in August that we made a final decision around what the surcharges would be and the final elements of the program. On slide 10, this speaks to our incentive rationale. So we've spent a lot of time discussing both positive incentives and negative incentives. And our staff research, the research of our consultants, all indicated that positive incentives do not drive change, but negative incentives unfortunately do. And so that is indeed the model that we chose. It was a difficult decision because everybody likes to hear about the positive and no one really likes to hear about the negative. But we also felt very strongly that we, in order to drive the change that was required, we needed a significant number of PEB members to participate in the program. And the research showed that positive incentives just did not drive that significant number.
I'd be interested in seeing some of that research because I'm quite familiar with research that indicates the opposite. So it indicates positive.
Can I clarify? I think that what Diane's suggesting is for health risk assessments to get the initial engagement, it's a high enough disincentive essentially to get them in the door for participation. But I think you're exactly right in terms of positive reinforcements around engagement and changing health behavior. So I think we can get you that though.
The other challenge that PEB had, one that you can, I'm sure, understand and identify with, is that we had no additional money for positive incentives. We were in a situation where we were reformatting our benefit design. We were making significant cuts in benefits. As you know, state employees were taking furlough days again, and there was just simply no additional money to create an incentive program, even if we thought it had been the best method to drive folks to taking the HRA, as Sean has pointed out. So our goal on slide 11, you'll see, was to really establish a successful program that over time would begin to save us money. This was not implemented in 2012 with any expectation that we would save money initially. In fact, we believe we may not see any actual change until year 3 or 4. But we hope to see that change, to save money, but definitely to improve the health of state employees, which has a number of other economic benefits and drivers. So we believe when PEB is implemented and we have people consistently following the guidelines,
following the advice that they received through the feedback of the health risk appraisal that we hopefully will begin to save about $7 million a year, which may seem very small in the overall PEB budget, but when it comes to looking at benefit changes and reductions, $7 million means a significant amount in preventing cost shift to state employees. So we chose to move forward and have tasked the staff with putting a program into operation, which they did for the October open enrollment. And they did a very significant amount of work and a great job at making it happen. So on slide 12, our goal is an effective program based on components that we believe will work and be effective. The first is participation, which is driven by incentives. An experience of our consultants show the following, that this is very specific to, again, the HRA, but no incentives lead to low participation, about 20% or less. Positive incentives, which cash, better benefits, other incentives, yield about a 55% participation at most. And negative incentives, such as loss or reduction of a benefit or an additional cost to members, such as the surcharges that we implemented, have seen up to a 90% participation. Successful programs average participation of 85% or better, and that is, frankly, where we are. We were very pleased to see an 85% participation in our program. So our program sets parameters around participation only, and this is just a very important issue. It is about engagement, it's about learning, it's about participation, it is not about outcomes. Members can choose to participate or not during their annual open enrollment. Deductions are taken only for not participating or for not completing a confidential online health assessment and two online health education lessons, and each of those are about 7 minutes, the e-lesson, so they don't take a great deal of time. The program has no requirements for screening, testing, reporting biometric results. It is solely based on taking the HRA and then taking action based on the results, and that action can be as small as those two e-lessons. Everything is HIPAA secure. People's medical privacy is not being invaded or eroded in any way. This information is held by the health plans. It is not held by PEB. PEB or the state has no access to any of this information. That's an extremely important to our members. It's important to PEB because we don't want any of that information. The information is extremely secure. So as I mentioned, 85% of state employees have elected to participate, and already 40% of them have completed the health assessment, and 10% of them have completed their e-lessons, even though they have until mid-July to do that. Many of them are taking the initiative and are really accomplishing that, and we hope are getting great benefit out of that. And we also hope that as people take those e-lessons and fill out those HRAs, that, again, focusing on the work side, they'll be sharing that it was, you know, hopefully a positive experience, that they actually learned something. I think another key important piece is they're not restricted only to lessons. They're not restricted to taking lessons around their particular health conditions. They can take advantage of a very huge library of e-lessons that both of our contracted health plans provide. So we hope that this has provided you some background and information around our HEM programs, and both Sean and I are going to be able to answer questions.
Are there questions?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just heard on the radio about some of the complaints that have happened from PEB members, and I just wonder if you could go into a little more detail about the nature of their complaints, how you're addressing that. It just seems like you hit on some of the ones that I had thought I understood, so...
Can you take it?
You can
start. I'll chime in. Chairs Greenlick and Thompson, Representative Kenny Geyer. We've heard a lot, quite frankly, from members, and rightfully so. I think we all would acknowledge that sort of the rollout and implementation of this initially didn't go as smoothly as anybody would have liked. We're trying to repair that damage right now, and I think we're getting there. I think based on these participation rates that you're seeing, I think people, once they're getting in, understand what the bar is. And it's not, again, to Diane's point, not about outcomes. It's about engagement and participation. And I think as we're getting as we're getting better and we're owning our communications more, I think the reaction's getting better. That's not to say that people still don't feel like that this isn't the right thing to do. Just yesterday, we had a very challenging conversation at the PEB board in response to some of the reactions we've been getting from members. And I think that we've been listening, and I think yesterday's decision by the PEB board to reflect that and some of the modifications to the design that we've done. So.
I would just add, Co-Chairs Greenleck and Thompson and Representative Kenny Geyer, that also as part of the collective bargaining process, a labor management committee was put into place of representatives from AFSCME, SEIU, and managers of the state. And they've been very busy looking at this issue, listening to state employees, and actually provided some recommendations to the board yesterday that we acted upon. And their focus really is to help us develop metrics so that we can measure actual impact, and also to really weigh in on the education and learning that we're hoping to provide. So, as Sean mentioned, just because of the short time frame and many other reasons, the rollout was not what we would have hoped. And so they are really stepping up and providing some great guidance to make sure that during these next 9 months and into the future, people can really understand that this really is a benefit for them and their families.
I think I heard this morning or yesterday that there's a lawsuit with some people who have a negative incentive, are objecting to it in court. Can you explain that? And can you get a sense of what will happen if the court is affirmed?
Well, Co-Chairs Greenleck and Kenimer, I do not think that I can give you that kind of legal advice. I've read the filing. There's an objection to being, quote, forced to participate in HEM via a choice of paying surcharges or not. And I really cannot comment on the legal aspects.
Well, I wasn't asking for the merit. What do you think of the merits? I was asking what happens if they win.
Well, I think the requested remedy is that the HEM would not be implemented, that we would be barred. If that were the case, then we would certainly seek guidance from the DOJ in terms of what a legal program would look like. But just to assure you that we did a lot of due diligence with the Department of Justice before this program was ever implemented. And so we feel quite confident that that challenge will not stand. But again, I will.
President Thompson.
One of the issues I think we're dealing with here, I've been working with these engagement models since the mid-80s in some narrower areas, but it's very easy to launch a health engagement program if you're getting a group of volunteers to come in and take part in it and you get results. The issue that we have here is we are telling a large group of people who did not volunteer that they are going to take part for the welfare of the program and themselves. I don't know how you ever get across that obstacle without pushback. No, and it's just kind of, I think it's kind of where we are in the system, but we all realize individuals are going to have to take greater responsibility for their health care, or we're going to break the bank. And that's not just PEB, that's healthcare across the nation. So I prefer to think of this as a bump in the road, and probably if I'd been your public relations agency, I would have advised you a little differently, but that's hindsight and whatnot. But I can tell you, being a legislator who always walks the walk, because that's a characteristic of legislators, I did avail myself of your weight loss program. I've lost 19 pounds in 5 weeks. My wife reminds me none of it was off my head. But the results can be obtained by engagement. And why didn't I do this 4 or 5 years ago? I don't know. Didn't get around to it. So I for one, think you are cautiously on the right road and applaud your efforts. The question is, can we translate this across a broad spectrum of people? And it's not just PEB. Because we're doing the health transformation rollout for the Medicaid population, that'll be even a tougher group.
Yes, it will.
But they cannot have unfettered access to health care without responsibility. And you're absolutely right. The 80% of the money going to 20% of the people with chronic disease. That's been my career working with in that model, mm-hmm. and we haven't moved the needle very much in there. We've got to make some bold steps and address those issues, or all the money for education and everything else is going to flow to healthcare, and we don't have it.
So. I would argue that that's not the. You know, the question is there actually long-term change in people's...
Well, that we don't know until we have long-term.
And that, I heard you say you're intending to look at that, because that's the important question. I mean, does it matter 3 years from now, 5 years from now, or is it...
Well, we won't know that if we don't do the 3 years from now in incremental steps.
I've lost 400 pounds over my...
It shows.
My lifetime. and... This is one last question I have. I assume you're aiming at really unhealthy things like the adrenaline junkies that ski and play racquetball and things like that. You're gonna try and deal with that, because that's a really huge risk for orthopedic services, I know.
Well, I am not a representative on Greenlick, co-chairs Greenlick and Thompson. I am not a state employee, so I didn't have the opportunity to take the health assessment, but it is my understanding that there are questions about physical activity on the health risk assessment.
Well, yeah, it assumes physical activity is good, but some
extreme physical activity can be dangerous.
Some is very bad, yeah. Right. You have a comment, Sean?
No. Not really.
Sorry.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Anything else? Guys, thank you very much for your prayer. Please
thank
keep
you.
Coming back and talking to us, because we're very much interested in seeing how this rules out as it as
be more than happy to.
Yes.
Thank
you
for
your
time today on a busy day.
Did you want me to bring up the gun question? Or
we almost made
around,
it out.
Around the head and neck enough on the gun question.
He knows.
But I didn't
Yeah, I will switch you on now. We do have some testimony on this from Kaiser in Providence, and I'll ask you to hold on a bit. I'd like to move the Wilsons up now and ask them to talk to us about, I think I learned it's pronounced Crabbe, is that right? Please introduce yourself.
Will do. My name is Tammy Wilson. I'm the mother of and family member of this wonderful household. We have two members at home. I'll get to them in a moment. Here to this direction, I have Marshall. He's 2.5 years old. My husband, David Wilson. My 16-month-old, Michael Wilson. And my daughter, my oldest, Melanie Wilson. She is 10 years of age. I have two children at home. My son, Mason, who just turned 9 years of age. And then my actual biological paternal nephew, Bryce, who we are seeking legal adoption through DHS. And hopefully that will be legal, and he will be of my own in April. So thank you for meeting with us. To tell you a little bit about our family, David and I have for the most of our adult life have lived here in Oregon, and we have built a home in Yamhill County in the Dayton area, and we have been there for the better half of 7-8 years, which I have, once we built our foundation there and started our family there, I have actually become a very involved in our community. I have held several chair positions with the city of Dayton, as well as established their Harvest Festival. I'm one of the originators of that particular festival. So I'm very involved in the community, very involved in legislation as far as on the city level. And actually, in the last 2 years, had to withdraw from that busyness of life due to the new journey our family has encountered. My son Marshall was developing as normal, met every single milestone as every baby should through first year of age. We celebrated his first birthday. I was certain he was going to be walking before his first birthday at 11 months old. He was taking the steps. I remember my husband and I sitting in the living room, spaced out, encouraging him to walk back and forth to us. I remember him taking his toy walker and racing down the hallway. I remember him crawling with a little fishtail as fast as he could, just to get as fast as he could to chase his sister. Then it was about 13, 14 months of age. We noticed he would just stand in a V shape, not wanting to take steps, and frustrated all at the same time. And that's when our concern grew. We took him to the pediatrician. They ran tests. Everything came back normal. But by that point, over the course of 2 weeks, more things had begun to show. For example, he started losing his ability to support himself, sitting up or even supporting his head. Then we were referred to DCH, Dornbecker Children's Hospital, for further testing. Over the course of several months, we met with the neurology team. He was theoretically diagnosed with MLD, metachromatic leukodystrophy, which is still in the leukodystrophy family, which is what Krabbe's is. Krabbe is actually GLD, globoid leukodystrophy. It's just another missing enzyme. Leukodystrophies are filled with enzymes. And then further testing happened, genetic testing happened.
Would you say again what you just said for us?
Sure. Leukodystrophy is an enzyme, a missing enzyme in your body. Your enzymes send signals between your brain and your nervous system. And without those enzymes, if they're not being protected, then they miss the signals being transferred from your brain to your body and functioning in every aspect. Just to give you a very small picture of the complexity of it. With enzyme screening, we had him tested for enzyme and discovered that he had a zero level of GALC. That's the acronym for the long medical term of this particular disease, which translates into Krabbe's disease. He's lacking the enzyme to protect that particular enzyme operation back and forth between the brain and the nervous system. So it's only been a year and a half, and over that year, the better half of the first 9 months of his life, he went from being a completely normal child, meeting his milestones, to, it was literally watching our child reverse milestones. We went from watching him no longer take walks, to no longer crawl, to no longer be able to sit up, to no longer to be able to roll over. And then eventually, we had to get him a Mickey bun, a surgical insertion into his belly to make sure he gets the proper nutrition. By the time that surgery happened, we barely missed the window of even being able to feed him by mouth, as it became difficult and difficult. By the time a surgery took place, it took him almost an hour to suck a bottle of milk. And at that point, he was no longer even eating solid foods. He could try to swallow them, but being able to properly direct them down into his stomach was too much of a high risk for aspiration and potential pneumonia. So this disease has several milestones. The nervous system, after his surgery, he encountered a tremendous amount of pain. We had no idea what it was, and neither did our doctors. We just knew it wasn't because of the surgery. I contacted a specialist that actually specializes in Krabbe's disease. Just over the phone, she immediately diagnosed it as nerve pain. So again, over the course of 9 months, my son has went to basically a vegetation state. He can no longer eat by mouth. His nutrition is given by his G-tube in his stomach. He can no longer see. He can no longer hear. And these are just signals because his brain is not communicating with his nervous system. It's like they lose the communication between one another. They're trying, but it's like a static field. Something ends up interfering with it, so the full signal doesn't get to the operation. So again, my son can no longer hear. He can no longer see. The only sensories he has is smell and feel and taste. However, we can no longer give him anything to taste in the fear of aspiration leading to pneumonia, which could potentially take his life because he no longer has a body to fight. My son just recently recovered from pneumonia / RSV with round-the-clock 24-hour care between my husband and I and our two family members that are also caretakers with Marshall. Our care for him is 24 hours daily. Because he can no longer swallow properly, we suction him. We take his vital signs on a constant basis to make sure his heart rate and his oxygen saturation is at the levels it should be, because he can't talk to us. He can't tell us when he's sick. This pneumonia was all of a sudden and very sporadic. We thought that we were just dealing with a different illness when his heart rate started jumping. And lo and behold, he ended up with pneumonia. It's his first case, but it's very harsh and brutal for our children. So Marshall has had to face all of that. He encounters, as you can see, he sits in his wheelchair. We reposition him ourselves. He has no mobility whatsoever. He has seizures on a regular basis. He has seizures 4 to 5 times a day. They look like just spasms. Fortunately, these particular seizures, he's on medication to help with his nerve pain, his muscle spasms, his seizures, his irritability, just to make him comfortable and give him the best quality life as possible. And the reason why we are here today, Marshall has a brother, Michael. We had him tested. Every medical doctor encouraged us to test him. Marshall started showing symptoms at 13 months of age. So Michael, at 4 months of age, was diagnosed with Krabbe's disease as well. Keep in mind, we have two older children completely healthy, and for 6 years, our life was completely normal. Had no idea of this disease. So Michael was born, we underwent testing, and found out he had Krabbe's disease. They encouraged us to transplant, cord blood transplant. So we explored our options and our avenues, and we elected to do so because the risks outweighed his life expectancy. There's several stages to Krabbe's disease. There's early infantile, which 6 months and younger start showing symptoms, and usually their life expectancy is only 2 years, up to 2 years. And then there's late infantile, which is what Marshall has, 6 months up to 2 years. And their life expectancy is anywhere from 2 to maybe 5, 7 years. So we just recently came back from Pittsburgh, where our specialist is, and the disease for Marshall has reached his brainstem, which means it's a matter of time. Your brainstem controls everything, every major organ of your body. So it's just a matter of time before this disease attacks one of his major parts of his body, maybe his heart, and then he'll give out. So we don't really know at this point his life expectancy. We're guessing we have the best of 2 years at best. However, there's days we feel like we only have... We'll be glad to see if he makes it to his birthday, which is June. So we honestly believe that Marshall came to this earth to save his brother. And I say that because I'm still shocked I got pregnant. And I honestly believe that Marshall came here to Earth to save his brother Michael. And you would have to witness their connection between one another during Michael's transplant. And I'll get into the details of why of the treatment for this disease in a moment. But we would be in the hospital. My husband and I would take shifts. He would be there during the day. I would be there on the weekends. Well, he would be there through the week, and I would be there on the weekends, so that a parent was always with both sides of our world, meaning who was at home and who was at the hospital. Every time Marshall got sick, Michael got sick. They weren't even in the same city. They weren't even in the same house. And when we figured out that connection, we would immediately call home, so-and-so sick, because guess what? He's sick now. Yes, he's sick. they're not feeling well. So I'm just trying to give you a relationship, their relationship, an ideal of their relationship and how we feel. So going back to the Krebs disease, we were encouraged to go follow through with the cord blood transplant. We actually, there's several types of bone marrow transplants. The cord blood is the most richest, and we were able to find a donor that had six types. There's different types that Michael needed in order for the transplant to be successful. And normally they'll take a donor as long as you have four types. Michael's donor had all six types that was necessary for the transplant, so that just made the transplant even more successful. So we elected to do the transplant. March 31st of last year, we went into Dornbecker to do the transplant. And the reason why we elected is because Michael was not symptomatic, so he had a fair chance. We have met other families who have had transplants, and some were symptomatic and some weren't. Doctors to this day will not transplant a child if they are too far along in the disease. Marshall did not get that chance. He was only 2 months into the 3 months into the disease, and he was too far along in the disease to be transplanted. We could not save our son. In Europe, they send their home children on hospice with no treatment, no quality of life, and they live maybe 15 months. We were fortunate enough to find a specialist here in the United States that has Marshall on a medicine regimen and a preventative program to give him longevity and the best quality of life. We by no means want Marshall to suffer in any way. Believe me, I've prayed many nights for my son to leave this world just so that he would find peace. But I know that he's comfortable, and I know that he picked me as his mother to complete a mission to help save other babies, and that's why we're here. Michael is 16 months old now. He should have been showing signs 3 months ago. And all of you, just in the last hour, have been able to witness his activity. At 6 months of age, Marshall couldn't roll over, and he wasn't even feeding by mouth. And all he could see was all he could do was hear and see and maybe smile. Now he can't even do that. Marshall does not smile. I don't ever see a smile from him. He's lost that. Marshall can't hear me say I love you. And Marshall can't see Michael grow up. So I'm asking for the state of Oregon pass a law or create a bill to test not only Krebs disease, but all treatable diseases. Because everybody should have a chance at life. So, did I forget anything? Okay. Do you mind if you said anything?
Not at all. Please introduce yourself, Mr. Wilson.
Hi, my name is David Wilson. And obviously, I'm the dad of this tribe here. So, Marshall here, he was one of those kids that was a very happy-go-lucky kid. And, of course, when the walking issues started happening, we were definitely worried about it. And then we had to go through the whole process of all the doctor's appointments and everything else. We actually, he got his CT or MRI scan 1 week after Michael was born. We actually induced Michael one day early just so my wife could be at Dornbecker's for the MRI. That first weekend after the MRI, we actually spent that weekend in the hospital at Dornbecker so they could run additional tests. And on that weekend, we had both Michael and Marshall in the same crib in the hospital. And Marshall was playing with Michael at that point because Michael was only like 6 days old. And then when Michael went into the hospital, he was actually supposed to go in the hospital for 55 days with a cord blood transplant. And he wound up being in the hospital for 200 days. And the reason why is because he had some side effects of the chemotherapy. The chemotherapy itself caused major other issues with this boy that not affected by the Krabbe's disease. And so every time that we would change out, we would bring, usually Marshall would come up with one of us, and we spent a little time together as a family up at the hospital, and now it was reversed. Now we have Michael in the crib with Marshall, and Michael's playing with Marshall, because Marshall can't do anything. That's some of the stuff that we've seen. You know, we've made sure that those boys are always together, because they, you know, a lot of people that see them, they see the same thing that we see, where it's kind of like having a set of twins. With the way they connect with each other, it's kind of a great thing to see. And of course, Michael had some side effects with the chemotherapy, and developed a lot of other issues. Wound up having to be in ICU for 3 months. But as you can see him here, he's just smiling the entire time. And when he wasn't being incubated, he'd always have a smile on his face. He actually has a huge fan base right now at Dornbecker's, just because of the way that he handled himself up at the hospital. And, you know, our ultimate goal here is to have the universal newborn screening, where the state of Oregon is taking all the recommendations by the federal government on what to test for babies when they're first born, plus Krabbe's disease. And we know that by doing that, if every state did the full universal newborn screening, it would save about 3,400 kids a year. And one of the other things that we've seen here with all this is we've met other families across the United States, and we've talked to some that are in the UK and Italy, and I've just recently talked to somebody in Australia, and everybody is everywhere trying to fight for screening of this disease and all the, and anything that they can do to protect these kids from this kind of disease. Currently, there's other states in the union working on passing universal newborn screening. We got, we know California is working on it. We just talked to a lady in Tennessee who is working on it. The lady in Tennessee that's trying to push this through, she is actually 32 years old. Her name is Scarlett Measles. And at 16 years old, she was diagnosed with Krabbe's disease. And it depends on which doctor you talk to. Two different doctors have two different theories on the different levels of the disease, but basically she got diagnosed at age 16, got a bone marrow transplant there.
Excuse me, Mr. Wilson. We've been called to the floor, so we need to recess. We'll be back in about 10 minutes.
Okay, that's fine.
I think we have, I'm sure I have some questions. I expect others have some questions to ask you. Quite an extraordinary story, so.
Thanks.
But let's just recess. We have to go up to the floor and pretend we're there for a quorum and then come back down.
All right.
Thanks, Dave.
No problem. So I was talking about a lady in Tennessee by the name of Charlotte Measles. At age 16, she was just a standard high school cheerleader doing her thing. She started having problems with her legs and then started doing some testing, found out that she had the Krabbe's disease. And they took and did a transplant. This was back in 98 when they did the transplant. Back then, they were doing transplants on these children at most stages of the disease because they didn't totally understand everything yet. And nowadays, you know, most likely by the time she was able to go in for a transplant, she wouldn't have qualified for it by today's standards on it. But she got the transplant. This year, she hits 14 years from date of transplant. 32 years old. She is independent. She is married. She is restricted to a wheelchair. I'm not sure what else she has for issues, but she is also working with Tennessee trying to pass a UNBS for that. And then, of course, you know, Hunter's Hope program, which is Jim Kelly's, the quarterback, his group with his son Hunter that passed away, they are working at the federal level trying to have the federal government mandate for testing for UNBS along with the Krabbe's disease. So, I mean, there's definitely several states right now that are working on doing it. There's two states that have already passed. New York has passed, and New Jersey just passed just recently. This is definitely somewhat of a rare disease. We have to, when we go to the doctor's office, or that is a doctor that hasn't seen us before, or if we have to have an ambulance come out to our house, which we've had to do a couple times already because of this disease, we have to explain to them the do's and don'ts of this disease because most people don't know about it. It's one of those that nobody hears about. It has definitely, you know, made a toll on our life, changed our whole focus on what our future plans are for our life. You know, I think one of the biggest changes is definitely has had on us right now is just our day in and day out life schedule. I mean, most people don't have a hospital bed in the middle of their living room for their toddler. And my wife and I, we take turns every night who sleeps out in the living room with Marshall here, because Marshall has all kinds of equipment out there. You can't really see it right now, but there's two big bottles of oxygen back here because he requires oxygen a lot. We basically have half of our living room donated to medical equipment. We have a 6-foot shelf in our dining room that is just nothing but medical supplies. And then we have half our counter space in our kitchen donated to different medicines for both the boys. Michael is roughly about 16 months old later this month. At 16 months old, Marshall here, he had a little bit of head support left. He could still see, he could still hear, he could still smile. He could not crawl. He could not feed himself. He could not move around. He could not roll himself over. He couldn't raise his arm up to reach out to touch you. At really, you know, within about 2 months of where Michael is right now in his age group, he would have been, Marshall was close to a vegetative state at that point.
So, let's open up the floor. I think a lot of folks have some questions. So. Sure. Let's do that if that's okay with you.
I guess I'll start. I'm interested in the cord blood transfer process. So did you go through a cord blood bank, or was that through a private donation, or how did you get connected with that?
We actually went through a cord blood bank because of the little amount of blood that Michael will needed and the amount of rich cells a cord blood transplant or cord blood actually has, stem cell. They thought that it would be the best. It would be the best option for Michael. I think it varies case to case. I know that there's straight bone marrow from an actual relative donor. There's also the stem cell one that's not as rich in the proper cells, and then there's the cord blood, the umbilical cord blood, which is what Michael received, and we received that from a cord blood bank. They searched both in the United States and internationally, and his actual donor was international. And all we know is that it was from a boy.
Can I follow up?
Sure, please do.
Do you know, and it's just kind of for my own curiosity, because we went through a pretty significant medical crisis when I was pregnant and banked cord blood for two of the kids, and it's privately held. I'm just curious, when you were in that search, do they only search through public banks, or is there any data kept on private banks?
Go ahead.
It was my understanding the private bank, because I believe that's an expense to the family, and that's actually reserved for you. However, I also found out that some of your umbilical cord actually does go into the National Cord Blood Bank. So whatever amount that that's given, that's reserved for the actual open, not necessarily private, but open and available to all needing that particular type of transplant.
So that's where you would donate it, make that available. But if it's there for your family, you could certainly tap it.
Correct. Oh, absolutely.
But then it's also available for other families who need to tap that. I just always wonder, because I know that there's a significant expense having done it twice. Wish I would have done it the third time, or the first time, I guess I should say. I don't know how we raise more awareness for cord blood banking and the value of that.
It actually wouldn't have worked for our family. They wouldn't have accepted our siblings or... You know, if we did decide to reserve their cord blood for a future, this particular disease would not have been effective because that same cord blood is still carrying that disease.
Sure.
But that's just mine. I'm sure that it can save lives in so many other different ways.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you so much for your testimony. It's really incredible how you've been there for your family and your kids. Obviously, they get a lot of love.
Thank you.
So they lucked out in certain ways. Do you know what it costs to implement the kind of law that you're considering to have universal screening, including this and others?
As far as the law, I don't know the expense to that. However, for the testing itself, the Crabbe families across the United States have advocated that the one individual Crabbe testing itself, which actually tests for four other diseases, is $1. That being said, Hunter's Hope just recently started offering an actual screening kit for all of screenable lysosomal diseases, LSDs. And that's not all leukodystrophies are screenable just because the screening hasn't been perfected to be effective. Mm-hmm. But what they do have is a packet that a pharmaceutical company has allowed them to sell outright to families to test on an individual basis. And that tests not only for Krabbe, but whatever screenable leukodystrophy or other lysosomal diseases are available. There's up to 56 screenings out there, and most states, on average, test 39 of them.
Thank you. I was interested in, do you have health insurance to help you cover all of
yes,
those?
Yes,
we do.
Yeah, currently I have Providence, and then Marshall here, he qualifies for hospice, so we have some hospice care, and then we also have Medicaid on both Marshall and Michael. So
must be an extraordinary expense as well.
It's an unbelievable expense. The downside with the treatment for Krabbe's disease is, even though it's a process that has been used for other illnesses, but when they, I'm sure you guys know this, once you use something for something else, that they're still learning about it, then that's considered
experimental.
So a huge, huge expense on just the transplant itself, not counting the other things that we had to go through in the hospital with Michael. But yeah, it's a really big medical expense. You know, I'm fortunate enough to have a company that I work for that they donated a large amount of money to our family to help us out financially for this. And then we've had other friends jump in and help out. And then with the qualifying for Medicaid and hospice has helped us out quite a bit. Honestly, if it wasn't for all that, we'd probably be living at my parents' house right now just because of the amount of medical expenses that are out there. Plus, on top of all that, the only specialist in the world that is actually working with Crab Bay children is in Pittsburgh. So in the past year and a half, we've made three trips to Pittsburgh already just so the kids can get their checkups and get the medicines rearranged depending on the, mostly for him because of the position of the disease that he's in, because the medicines always have to be adjusted. And you know, so it's, we definitely see some expenses with what we're dealing with.
Representative Doherty?
And looking at Michael and reading some of the information on the disease, early detection, there are ways to diminish the disease quite a bit if it's very early detection.
Yes, basically, if you can catch the disease, which in like Michael's case, he went in for cord blood transplant at 4 months old, and he shouldn't start seeing any symptoms based on Marshall's time frame until after he turned a year old. So we had plenty of time for the cord blood to take effect and start working properly in his body. There's still a lot of unknowns out there, but theoretically, with a good transplant like he had, with no other side effects from the other stuff that we've had to deal with, he could theoretically live a average normal life.
So newborn testing would help people?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. The only part where the newborn screening is a little iffy on if it'll help is if it's a early infantile, because sometimes the children come out with symptoms already, but in some cases that can still help them out, and they're actually looking at being able to test for this why the baby is still in the womb and being able to do a transplant on the baby while the baby's still in the womb. That's something that they're working on right now.
Great. Thank you very much.
Well,
you know, Representative Hoyle and I would like to hear from Big Sister, who's pretty good big sister. Who's down there taking very good care of these brothers. I'm an older sister, and I know just how challenging it can be to have younger siblings, and so we'd like to just kind of hear how you're doing.
And please start by saying your name.
Well, my name is Melanie, and I'm the oldest in the family, and some of the time I feel like I'm just really helpful, and I am, but I feel like that I could help out a lot more than I am. And no child should go through this at all. And it's really scary some of the time. Like, a couple of nights ago, Marshall's been coughing, like, really well. Like, he's been choking, kind of. And it kind of wakes me up because it's really scary, and his monitor keeps beeping. So some of the time I ask my parents if he's going to be okay, and I'm just really scared that he's going to go away, and I don't want him to go away. And some of the time, whenever I'm sad, I kind of look at Michael because he cheers me up. And I tell my class what I'm going through, and they kind of help me out. And I have my fourth grade teacher. She really cares about my family, so during recess I go to her and I give her a little update on how the boys are doing. And then we start talking about a bunch more other things about Marshall and Michael, and just some of the time when Marshall had pneumonia and the other thing, Mom and Dad told me whenever we go near him or we touch him, we have to wash our hands. And that's, I don't like doing that because then I just feel like he's really, really sick, and he is. Just, I feel really bad for him. And I also tell my friends what I'm going through, and they really want to come over all the time and help us. And there's a bunch of people, mom, dad's friends, mom's friends, our family, all want to help us out, but we can only have a few at a time in different times. And most of the time we're really, really busy, so I have to stay home and help out, and I like helping out, but sometimes it's really, really hard because either Marshall's really sick and he's not doing well, or nobody's doing well, and it's just really scary. And then when I go on Facebook, I see all the updates my mom and dad give other people about Marshall and Michael. They pretty much talk about Marshall and Michael on Facebook. And I read those, and then I usually comment on them, and then I usually update some of the time on Facebook too. But I've been wanting to go on Caring Bridge to find out what's going on too. I mean, I know what's going on. It's just that might give me a little more details.
You know what, that's just a thank you for sharing that. And I know what Caring Bridge is, the website where you can go and share your story about what's happening in your family. And so I just think you're really brave, and I think you are a great big sister, and you can see how much you love your brothers, and I'm glad that you got a chance to tell us all of that.
Yeah. How about your big brother's a real pain? Well, thank you. Thank you so much for coming. I'm sure Representative Widener is going to have a bill for us in the 2013 session to talk about this, and we'll talk to the people in public health here. It's been wonderful for you to share your story with us. We were saying on the way out how we get to deal with these human issues, not other kinds of issues that other committees get to deal with. It. Really appreciate you guys coming. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Well, we appreciate you taking the time to listen to us.
Thank you.
I would like to just add one more thing. As the bill's generated and you further research this and try to make a decision in the best interest of everybody, you know, I know things will come up that might create a wall of uncertainty. And so I just want you to imprint Marshall and Michael in your head. If you don't transplant prior to symptoms, then you have Marshall's state of being with a life expectancy of less than, you know, they won't even see their teen years. But if you do transplant and the outcome is, you know, you have a better outcome of it, then you get this.
Sweet.
Yay. And I just really would like you to be imprint. I would just really like you to imprint Michael and Marshall in your head when you're making those decisions. Will it work for every single family? I don't know. But you have to try. They're babies.
Thank you very much.
And with that, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you very much.
Close the informational hearing on Krabbe disease. Said it wrong to start, maybe right to end. And thank you all for coming. We still have the informational hearing open on excuse me, on the health. Somebody else like to testify?
Yeah, we got a little.
You got two there.
So good you asked.
What have we got? Gene Poling, Greg Gary, and Kay Zimmer. Please. No, I have one more cough. Bronchitis is
How long have you had it?
3 weeks. I had pneumonia to start it. Please go ahead.
Co-chairs Greenlick and Thompson, members of the committee, my name is Brad Garrigus, and I'm the Director of Account Management for Providence Health Plan. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on...
Nice statement about Providence before.
Oh, yes. Providence Health Plan serves a number of employers, and so that was good to hear that we're serving that family as best we can. And I will note that it's difficult to follow such a powerful testimony, so my heart goes out to them. Given the comments by Mr. Colmer and Ms. Lavelle, I will keep my comments brief, as most of my comments echo what you've already heard. Providence Health Plan, as you're probably aware, is the administrator for the statewide PPO plan for PEB, as well as the PEB Choice Plan, which is a medical home model. In addition to PEB, we've implemented a number of other health engagement model programs with other employers, including January 1st of this year, Providence Health and Services here in Oregon implemented a similar program for its 15,000 benefit eligible employees. These other employers include manufacturers, auto companies, other public entities, and other quasi-public entities. You've already heard a number of issues related to the objectives of the program, as well as most of the common themes of the programs, including the fact that they are meant to create awareness amongst the employees and their dependents about their health status. I will just close with stating that the early outcomes for Providence Health Plan have demonstrated that the presence of these programs greatly enhanced the participation. We have a number of employers that have achieved close to 100% participation based upon the health engagement model programs that they have implemented. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Kay Zimmerle with Kaiser Permanente. And my title is HealthWorks Product Strategist, so I support the wellness initiatives for our large employer groups.
And I'm Co-Chair Greenlick and Thompson, representatives. I'm Jean Poling. I'm the account manager with Kaiser Permanente. My responsibility includes managing the PEB account, the group account.
Representative co-chairs and respective committee members. I wanted to just touch on one thing, and that is our mission at Kaiser Permanente is to be a leader in total health, and we have had a long history and focus on wellness and prevention as part of our approach to supporting our members. And total health, of course, is clinical as well as behavioral, as well as environmental, and then there's also the social component. It's a very complex issue to try to address behavior change and how we support and move that in the worksite to really help address the issues that are that we're facing. To Providence, we have worked with a large variety of employers in a variety of industries, and we've seen a trend where it's really gone from one spectrum to another around wellness, and we know that our employers are really struggling with how they take this next step on the journey to wellness. Many of them started out with more of a small incentive-based program trying to engage their employees, and that would get 15% to 25% participation levels. When they move to more of a cash incentive program, that would see initial bump in participation, but we would see that also taper off. But it would be, as they stated, in more of the 30% to 75%. But if you remove that incentive, you would see a change back in the behavior. For example, if you were incenting tobacco cessation and then you remove that incentive, what would happen there? Most people would be less inclined to maintain that. So what we've seen, and the same with weight loss, when you mentioned Representative Greenlick, you've lost 400 pounds, wasn't it? That, you know, it's very difficult. We all are going through a cycle of change, and it's very common to have to repeat that cycle and come back and start over. And we applaud the work that the HIM program is trying to support. For each and every one of us in the room, making change takes a different thing for each and every one of us, even if faced with the same challenges. And so the kind of program that we're seeing today, where it hits your pocketbook, gets you more aware
right up front. And what we're seeing is more of a trend with that with our employers, to your point, where you're getting a much higher participation level. And that's the step one to really garner that engagement. And at this point in time, the communication and the behavioral support through a variety of programs, which Kaiser Permanente is here to support, is where this needs to go next.
I have nothing to add.
I'm a Kaiser member. I have been for 50 years, something like that. And you offer the silver fit for the over 65 people, which allow Kaiser Medicare members. I think you have a very similar program to belong to a health club. And that's not a negative. It's a positive. I see in the pool at the health club where I am tons of Kaiser members taking up all those lanes. And I just read that the Center for Health Research, which you know I headed for 30 years, just had a report on teenage girls and their weight, the success in treating them. I mean, I think there are lots of ways that things can work. And at least I've had a problem from the beginning in dealing with the coercive side of it. It's always easier to go there, but why didn't we try a less coercive model first to see if it did work, to see how, what kind of long-term effects it might have to get people who are attracted to it by positive rewards rather than by negative rewards.
I'm happy to attempt to address that question, Co-Chair Greenlich. We have in the past had a number of programs in place, including personal health assessments, coaching, and decision support tools that have been available to our employers, their employees, and their dependents. And frankly, we haven't seen a large adoption or uptake of those programs in a voluntary state, if you will. I think that more progressive employers have understood that and are looking for ways, partly in an effort to reduce or control future costs, but also to improve their employees' health, quality of life, and productivity. They were looking for ways to cause employees to become a bit more engaged. And so that's where we've seen these wellness programs, like the health engagement model, begin to offer either incentives or negative incentives to participate. And the goal here really is participation. It's not outcomes-based.
I was talking about the difference between a positive incentive. Reward you $50 a month if you get involved rather than punishing you $50 a month if you don't. I mean, I think that's a very significant symbolic difference to me.
Co-Chair Greenlich, I agree with you, and I will offer a personal anecdote in that regard. Providence Health and Services, not only in Oregon, but for all of its employees a number of years ago, offered a health engagement model-like program with a relatively minor incentive of, I believe it was actually $75 in the form of gift cards, to participate in a health assessment and biometric screenings. The participation rate of that program was less than 10% over a 2 or 3 year period. And so recognizing that Providence Health and Services didn't get the participation we were looking for, this January we moved to a greater incentive, but at the same time we implemented a high deductible plan. So really we reduced our benefits substantially and then offered employees the opportunity to kind of buy back up based upon participation in these programs.
Jim?
One of the over the years I've worked in respiratory disease models for health engagement. One of the things that I noticed that doesn't seem to be part of anything on the table now is the addition of health worker counseling, not physicians and nurses, but just health monitoring individuals. I used to call it the hand on the shoulder technique. if patients are responsible to somebody for weekly or monthly progress, they tend to do better. And I think Alcoholics Anonymous may be a good example of that kind of thing in another way. But I'm not seeing it discussed much anymore in terms of these kinds of programs we're rolling out. And it seems to me that assigning a health counselor to these cases might get us, especially the difficult cases, get us a bigger bang for our buck than taking a hammer to their kneecaps, which that works. But I'm not hearing it discussed anywhere.
I'd be happy to respond. Representative co-chairs and Representative Thompson. We offer a variety of programs, as does Providence, to support our members through telephonic health coaching. We also have outreach programs to get people in for preventive care, as well as to make sure that if they have a chronic condition, that they are getting the appropriate counseling and support. We have an automatic disease registry strategy. And when our members take a total health assessment, they have the option of having that information part of their medical record. When they make that choice, we review their results, and if it is, if there are any conditions or causes for concern, we automatically reach out to the members to support and engage them appropriately. Now, everyone has a different learning style, and so we do have a variety of options from worksite programs. One of the things that we've recently been implementing as one of the things we consider very important is exercise, and we're implementing exercise as a vital sign, so that when you go in and meet with your physician, that's one of the questions you're asked is about how many minutes of exercise you have. And if you're not meeting the minimum guidelines of 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week, then your doctor may even write you a prescription for that with recommendations. So, you know, for each individual, they're going to respond differently. And so our portfolio includes tools to support in a variety of ways.
I'm particularly interested in that 20% that eats up 80% of the money. And even more so, the 5% that eats up most of that chunk of the money. But we've got to get at those people as patients and find out individually what we can do to drive down their medical costs.
Jim, some of those people are just sick.
Well, we should cure them.
Yeah. I mean, I was in that, you know, having lymphoma and then other kinds of surgery. I mean, I don't think, I quit smoking a long time ago and I still have it.
But it's, you know, we need to understand. I think we need to understand better where that money's going.
All right. Well, thank you guys very much. I'm sorry you had a sister, though. I'm sure you found the Wilson's story pretty interesting story.
Very powerful story.
And thank you guys all. I think we just have one bill on the docket for Monday, but we're in 1 hour notice time, and some more bills that come over the Senate, we may. They post a new agenda, so stay tuned. You'll let us know individually if there's a new agenda comes out. Great. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Close the informational hearing on the HEM, and we are adjourned.